Okay, so what I'd like to tell you about today is the work done by Tony Lee, who's a joint postdoc between my lab and Moomin Poo's lab. So he's also supported by the funding from TDLC. So obviously, he'll be a much better person to give this talk than me. Unfortunately, he went back to China in December, and he's been stuck there ever since. I don't know why they picked him to do a security check. Maybe he looks like a terrorist. Anyway, so what Tony set out to do was actually asking a question that's directly related to a lot of the questions we're interested in the network, which is how synaptic learning rule depends on the global state of the brain. So what do I mean by the global state? Now, obviously, we know that the brain has different states. If you just measure it from with EEG, you know that when you're in slow wave sleep, you have these really large amplitude slow signals. And when you're dreaming or when you're awake, then the brain is a lot more desynchronized. So we also know that the different brain states probably mediate different behavior. When you're having these theta and gamma activity, you're probably really paying attention to the external world and trying to take in the sensory information. But for example, when you're asleep, one idea is that one function of sleep is to consolidate memory. So there's this idea that maybe the memory that you collect during the day can be replayed or rehearsed in sleep. So a natural question is, how does local synaptic learning, which we believe is a cellular mechanism, a main cellular mechanism mediating learning and memory, how does that depend on the global brain state? So Tony actually has some preliminary data on that, and I can just sort of tell you what we think is going on. It looks like when the brain is in this up-down state, which we believe is similar to the slow wave sleep state, it looks like the spike timing-dependent plasticity actually has a different window than if you test the plasticity rule during the more desynchronized state. Unfortunately, he doesn't have the data in a presentable form, and he's now stuck in China, so I can't really present that work. And instead, what I'll tell you about is something that he actually found, which is pretty striking, but he very much found it by accident when he was asking this other question that I just explained. So the basic finding is that burst spiking of a single cortical neuron can actually modify the global brain state. So this is sort of in the opposite direction, right? He set out asking, how does the brain state affect, synaptic spiking learning rule? And instead, he found there's this reciprocal interaction. So this is how he did experiment. It's actually very simple. He was making whole cell recording in vivo in urethane anesthetized rat. And so this is anesthesia that tends to give you this up-down state, which is similar to what you get during slow wave sleep. So he was making whole cell recording one of the cells in the visual cortex. And in later experiment, it turns out that he doesn't have to patch the cells in the visual cortex. Anywhere is fine. But anyway, so this is the initial experiment. He was also making a local field recording simultaneously somewhere away, right? We didn't care where it was. It could be in the opposite hemisphere, but usually it's several millimeters away from the whole cell recording. So this is a trace of the whole cell recording, right? So what's plotted here is the membrane potential as a function of time, and 1 second is this much. So you can see this very clear up and down state. So this is one of the states that we see, right? So we have this urethane anesthetized rat, and if you just patch a cell, sometimes you see this up-down state, but sometimes you see this sort of very fast, the cell is always sitting in a depolarized state. So we call this the persistent up state. And just based on the membrane potential, we think that this is more like the REM sleep state, right? Obviously, there are other variables that we're not observing, but it looks like it looks similar to that. So this would be more like the slow wave sleep state. Now, this is a simultaneous recording, local field recording, and you can see that during this up-down state, the local field is actually very correlated with the whole cell recording, right? So remember, these recordings were made actually several millimeters away, which is pretty long distance in the rat brain. And during this persistent up state, if the single cell is sitting in the persistent up state, then the local field also shows a very different pattern, right? So it's a very fast and small amplitude fluctuation. So this just summarizes the membrane potential distribution of the whole cell. What's plotted here is the probability of the cell sitting at different membrane potentials. The three different colors represent three different cells. And you can see that for each cell, there is this bimodal distribution, and that corresponds to the downstate and the upstate. And this is the persistent upstate, so you see that it's a unimodal distribution. Now, this is the power spectrum of the local field recording. So during this up and down state, you can see there's a lot of slow, large empty, signals, and that corresponds to this huge peak at low frequencies. And of course, at the persistent up state, this peak at the low frequency is largely missing. So I guess the bottom line is that this kind of slow oscillation is a global pattern because you can see it in two recordings separated by large distance. So this is the main finding that that he had. Now this is a cell, again, this is intracellular recording, patch clamp. So initially you see this up and down state, and this is a local field. Again, it's very correlated at that time scale. And this is the membrane potential distribution as a function of time. So during this period, you see there are two bands, right? And so this is the membrane potential, and that corresponds to the upstate and the downstate. So the cell is, you know, flipping up and down constantly. And the local field, this is the power spectrum, right? Frequency and power is color-coded as a function of time. So you see this huge power at low frequency. Now what he did was that he did something to this one cell that he patched, right? So he depolarized the cell very hard and forced the cell to burst at high frequency. Now in this case, the burst frequency is probably something like 50 hertz. So he would do this for a few hundred milliseconds, right? So he depolarizes the cell, so the cell will be firing like crazy, right? And then he hyperpolarizes the cell, let the cell rest for a few seconds. And then he burst again, rest again, right? So he keeps doing this. Every few seconds. And after about 3 minutes, you can see that this cell shifted from this up-down state to this persistent up state. And of course, initially when we saw this, we said, oh, you know, maybe you'll kill the cell, right? The cell is getting leaky, and so, you know, the current flow in is depolarized. But if you look at what happens in a local field recorded several millimeters away, it's doing the same thing, right? So this is the original trace, and this is the power spectrum. You see a huge reduction of this low-frequency power. And this is just a quantification of this power spectrum. So what we plot here is the ratio between the low-frequency power and the high-frequency power. So you can see initially you have this huge ratio, and then after this burst, it's dropped to a low ratio. And we basically look for this sudden drop, right, across 3 minutes, this sudden drop of the ratio, and you can easily set confidence interval threshold. So that allows you to identify this sort of switch in the global brain state. So this is one example, and this is just another example, very much in parallel. The only difference is that this cell, again, is initially doing this up-down state thing, and then after the burst, the cell switched to the up state. And this effect only lasted for about 5 minutes. And then the cell, without us doing anything, without Tony doing anything, the cell actually switched back spontaneously to the up-down state. And the local field is showing the corresponding change. So it turns out that this kind of high-frequency burst can also induce the opposite change. So it's bidirectional. Now, here are two examples where when we started the recording, you see this persistent upstate, right? The cell is firing tonically. And then after this burst, right? So this is one example of the burst, and he keeps doing this every few seconds for 3 minutes. And afterwards, you can see that the cell switch this up-down state, and the local field shows this corresponding change. And this is an example of the long-lasting change, and this is an example of a transient change, right? So after a few minutes, the cell and the local field switch back. This is the summary of the time course of the effect. So like I said, we use the ratio between the low-frequency power and high-frequency power, right? So you have this trace, and then after the burst, you see this sudden switch. So we use that as a way to automatically identify the so-called switch. So this is the distribution of the time of the switch that's induced by our burst. So this gray shading is the 3 minutes of burst. And in fact, if you look at this distribution, Obviously, some of them happen later in this sort of periodic burst. But in some cases, they actually happened quite early, right? You don't need a whole 3 minutes of burst in order to induce this shift. So it almost looks like, you know, when we go back and look at the raw data, it almost looks like every time you burst, there's a certain probability of triggering this, the brain state change. But it may or may not happen. But if you keep doing this, then the probability of this happening would be higher. And this is the distribution of the time for the spontaneous switch back. So you can see that this has a much broader distribution. And in some cases, it never switched back before we lost the cell. So this effect depends very much on the burst frequency. So this is actually the control. What we did here was we, so in each experiment, we always recorded the cell in the local field for 10 minutes just to establish a stable baseline before we do the burst. And so in this case, after 10 minutes, we just picked that 3 minute period and said, okay, let's pretend this is a burst. But in fact, Tony didn't do anything to the cell. And if you just look at that, right, the probability of seeing the switch over this 3 minute gap is 1 out of 32, right? So there is a probability of spontaneous switch. And in fact, you see that even in our induced shift, sometimes it shifts back. So if you use the burst frequency at 5 hertz, you see 2 out of 12 cases where we see this switch. But if you go up to 25 or even higher, 50 to 100 hertz, then the probability of seeing this switch over a 3 minute period is a lot higher. It's about 40%. So this is the basic finding that he made. Now, obviously the mechanism, that's the next question. And to tell the truth, we have really not much idea about what's going on. We have a few guesses. Now, this is actually a plot that I borrowed from another story, not done by Tony, but just to show you the anatomy. So Tony was making this burst in either in V1 or some other sensory, or it doesn't matter where he was doing it, but he can induce his global shift. So one possibility is that, so the first question is, what leads to the change from this single neuron, right? You know you're doing something to this neuron. And where do you go from there, right? So how does that change this global brain change? So obviously that single neuron is not gonna project to everywhere in the brain, right? It projects to 1,000 other cells probably. So what we think is going on is that this burst, high frequency burst of the neuron has to cause some changes in the local cortical circuit within that column or neighboring columns, something like that. And then one possibility is that maybe the change in the dynamics of the local circuit just sort of propagate horizontally within the cortex. Now, that's not my favorite model because we actually tried very hard to see whether there's a delay between the switch in the single cell we're recording from and local field. We couldn't see any delay, but obviously there's also some uncertainty as to exactly when that switch has happened. But we couldn't see anything. So the other possibility, which is my favorite, is that maybe whenever you change something in a local circuit, there's a huge feedback to the thalamus. And because the thalamus is a more compact circuit, so maybe you can change the thalamus dynamics. And then because it's connected to the overall cortex, so that broadcast is changed to the entire cortex. Now, other possibilities are, in the lab, we're also studying the effect of nucleobasal stimulation, which provides the cholinergic input to the entire brain. And we know that there's some feedback from the cortex to nucleobasalis. And also there are these brainstem, I guess somewhere here, there are all these neuromodulatory circuits that control sleep and wake states. So we don't know, but I think that the next step is that we should go to the to the thalamus and see what happens there. So now, you might want to ask now, what's the relevance of this, right? So we know that this effect really requires some high-frequency bursts. So what it means is that because we are driving the cell very hard, and naturally the cells, you know, they fire, right, especially during up and down state. But probably they don't fire often at that high frequency for a few hundred milliseconds. So that's why the probability of this spontaneous switch is low. And then the question is, you know, how often do you get a natural physiological situation that one cell would fire that frequency, right? Probably not much. So, but what we think this tells us is that we need to rethink about how the cortex works. At least for me personally in the past, right? So we, you know, if you're a physiologist like me dropping your electrode into the brain in vivo, as you go down, you can hear the cell being killed by your electrode left and right, right? And then you don't worry about it. You just say, you know, the brain has a lot of neurons, so, you know, the rest of the brain works just fine, right? But I think that we shouldn't use that observation. I think it's true that the brain has a lot of redundancy, the different neurons can compensate each other, but we should also not underestimate the power of a single neuron, because at least what our result shows is that if you drive the neuron very hard, you can actually cause a pretty dramatic change. And in fact, there are some related findings from Bert Sapman's lab, actually done by Michael Brecht, first in Bert Sapman's lab, and now in his own lab. What they showed is that if you stimulate a single neuron in the somatosensory cortex or the motor cortex, you can actually cause a behaviorally detectable response of the rat, right? So the rat can actually tell that one of the neurons in his cortex is being activated. So I won't, for the sake of time, I won't go through this result, but this is from a paper from Michael Bragg's lab. So I think that's it. Yeah, thank you.
About the spatial temporal patterning of the field changes. How many microns does it extend?
So what we know is that we often put our local field electrode at least 5 or 6 millimeters away. The rat's brain is, I don't know how long, but so there, we actually went pretty front. Usually local field electrode is more or less in the frontal cortex. And we can't go much more frontal because there's some blood vessel stuff. It's all technical reasons. But I actually believe that it's pretty global. I think that even if we move even further away, I think it's doing the same thing. Terry? Oh, sorry.
Our measurements of the whisker evoked spiking in awake behaving animals show that on the order of 1,000 neurons in a given column will spike once with each whisker deflection. And I just wonder if you presumably know the density of spiking you're getting in one neuron that drives these transition changes. If we just made the assumption that because of spatial summation that one spike from 1,000 neurons would be equivalent, that might be an argument that a sensory stimulus could launch this. And given that in that regard, I wonder how you see this relating to Carl Peterson's finding that in a quiet animal, when you wiggle a whisker, you start a wave of activity that spreads measurably over a whole hemisphere sometimes.
Yeah, so the first question, I can only give you some estimate. I really don't know what's going on. It's still sort of mind-boggling, right? But I think that part of the one way that driving a single neuron very hard might be different from driving many neurons not that hard is that I think the cortical synapses are usually quite weak. And the general rule is that if you have weak synapses, then synaptic short-term facilitation is stronger than depression. So I think that there might be some, obviously we like to know what's the response of the local circuit to this very high frequency burst of that single neuron. But it might actually be a bit more powerful than having, several scattered neurons sort of firing it. I mean, but that's hand waving. I really don't know. I'm just guessing. The other question related to Carl Peterson's finding, I think that that's actually very much related to this whole brain state business. Now, we have this other study, Mike Gord, looking at cholinergic activation on the cortical dynamics. And it's very clear that under urethane anesthesia, which is probably different from the Carl's quiet state, right? But I think there's some analogy there, is that the circuits are much more synchronized, right? And you can, give a flash visual stimulus equivalent to a whisker wiggling, you can drive a wave of activity. But, when you stimulate the basal forebrain, when the brain is in this so-called activated state, then, any sensory stimulus, the response is a lot sparser, right? You don't have this sort of correlated activity of a large number of neurons. And then I think that, there's some biophysical mechanism for that because you know, acetylcholine, muscarinic receptor is known to depress the intracortical synapse.
So you showed, I think, at least one example of stimulation leading from an activated state to a up-down state. And how common was that?
So we pretty much see which direction it goes. It's very much determined by which state we ended up with, right? So if you start out up and down, there are two outcomes. Either you can induce the change or you shift it to up, right? Or if you start with up, you don't change or you go down. And actually, in the cases where we see the switch, we didn't see any clear difference in the probability of inducing the change from up down to up or up, you know, up to up down. They're both about 40% over the 3 minutes.
Okay, thank you.